condemns Britain's decision to declare Palestinian resistance movement Hamas a terrorist group, saying Palestinians' rights cannot be trampled on by distorting facts. China calls on all parties to the 2015 nuclear deal to step up diplomatic efforts and take concrete action to advance the upcoming talks in Vienna. Also in the headlines, several people are injured as Dutch police fire warning shots during a protest against COVID measures in Rotterdam. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Iran condemns the UK's move to declare the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas a terrorist organization. Iran's foreign minister says the rights of Palestinians cannot be trampled on by distorting facts. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says holding a referendum among the indigenous residents of Palestine is the only political solution for the Palestinian issue. Hamas also condemned the UK's move as a crime against the Palestinian people.
The British Home Office's decision to consider Hamas a terrorist organization is a crime against our Palestinian people and all their history of a struggle, as well as a condemnation of the legitimate struggles of all free peoples against colonialism. This decision, if implemented, is considered a great political, moral, and legal sin committed by Britain, in addition to its first crime of establishing the Zionist entity and making the Balfour Declaration.
The spokesman said Britain's move encourages the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities against Palestinians. The UK's decision adds the political wing of Hamas to an existing ban on its military wing. Under the changes, any act of support for Hamas will be punishable by up to 14 years in prison. London has cited what it calls the movement's, quote, significant terrorist capability, including access to extensive and sophisticated weaponry. This is while the group has been using its weapons to defend the Gaza Strip, which is besieged against Israeli aggression. China calls on all parties to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal to step up diplomatic efforts and take concrete action to advance the upcoming talks in Vienna. A foreign ministry spokesman says the implementation of the accord is the only effective way to resolve outstanding issues. Zhao Lijian said all relevant parties should exercise restraint and avoid any move that disrupts the diplomatic push for negotiations. The comments come as signatories to the deal, known as the JCPOA, are set to meet on November 29th for a seventh round of talks. Tehran says the negotiations will be focused on the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. The US imposed the bans on Iran after pulling out of the deal in 2018.
As the clock is ticking for a new round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, Washington is showing more signs of unwillingness to settle disagreements despite earlier comments made by U.S. officials. On Thursday, Washington announced new sanctions on six Iranian nationals and one entity, accusing them of intimidating and influencing American voters during last year's presidential election. Iran's foreign ministry condemned the new sanctions as illegitimate and baseless. It said the new bans are a continuation of the failed maximum pressure policy adopted by the previous U.S. administration. Tehran also highlighted Washington's long history of meddling in other countries' internal affairs and playing a blame game to deceive the American public. Analysts say there is no evidence of any interference by Iran in the U.S.'s 2020 presidential race.
There's no evidence whatsoever that Iran or Russia had any meddling, any interference with American elections. The only meddlers in the election was really the Democrat Party and the Mossad and the Israeli intelligence operations and the CIA. They've been perfecting these programs for over 15 years, and they've undermined the elections in other countries, such as Ukraine and Venezuela, and that was admitted to by people like John McCain and John Bolton and Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. These elections in America have been farces and completely manipulated by the technology that the U.S. developed for influencing and corrupting other elections. But they are attempting to constantly brand Iran as a threat to the United States and trying to whip up frenzy in the American people.
U.S. President Joe Biden and his Democratic Party repeatedly criticized Donald Trump during his term for his way of dealing with Iran and withdrawing from the 2015 nuclear agreement. But ironically, since he came to power, Biden persisted in his predecessor's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran and even imposed more sanctions against the Islamic Republic. This is why U.S. media and officials have admitted that the campaign against Iran has failed. Tehran held several rounds of talks with the FIPOR Plus One group between April and June with the aim of removing the sanctions, but no breakthrough was reached. Now, as the new round of talks scheduled to start on November 29th draws nearer, the U.S. measures against Iran further question Washington's sincerity about the issue, regardless of which party is at the helm in the White House.
Bahrainis have taken to the streets to denounce the Al Khalifa regime for hosting an Israeli delegation at a security forum. The demonstrators voiced anger at the raising of the Israeli flag during the Manama Dialogue Forum, which kicked off on Friday. They also slammed the international community's disregard for the demands of the Bahraini people. Bahrainis have been staging rallies against Manama's ties with the Israeli regime since the U.S.-mediated normalization deal was signed last September. The kingdom has also been the scene of regular anti-regime protests ever since a popular uprising began in mid-February 2011. Political commentator Faraz Al-Najm says extending an invitation to the Israeli delegation further exposes the real face of the Al Khalifa regime after it normalized ties with Israel.
Because today's developments shows who this regime is. You know, this regime has normalized publicly and proudly with one of the biggest criminal regimes in the whole region of the Middle East that has been, you know, killing the Palestinian people for so many years. We're talking about over 73 years of occupation, human rights violations, international law breaches. Instability of the whole region is because of the Zionist regime and its allies. So the Bahraini regime does not care about human rights whatsoever. As we can see, even the opposition inside Bahrain has all been put in prison, illegally detained. And many of them have got life sentences just for protesting and for standing up for basic freedom of speech.
Several people have been wounded in the Dutch city of Rotterdam as police fire shots and water cannons to disperse a major protest against COVID restrictions. The demonstrators fought back, hurling rocks at officers and setting debris on fire. Police have issued an emergency order and have shut down public transportation in the area. It came as hundreds have gathered to voice their opposition to new coronavirus restrictions, including a health pass requirement to access indoor venues. The Netherlands is struggling against the new surge in coronavirus cases, which pushed the daily infections to an all-time high on Friday. A U.S. court has cleared a militia member who killed two anti-racism protesters and injured a third in Kenosha, Wisconsin last year.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Kyle H. Rittenhouse, not guilty.
Members of the jury, are these your unanimous verdict?
Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted of all charges after the jury decided that he acted in self-defense. The 18-year-old was part of a self-declared militia which roamed the streets of Kenosha during the anti-racism protests of August 2020. The demonstrations began after a white officer shot and paralyzed Jacob Blake, an African-American father of two. The trial has raised criticism of the U.S. justice system over its discriminatory treatment of white militia members and anti-racism protesters. Colin Campbell joins us. He's our correspondent in Washington, D.C. Colin, so acquitted of all charges, what's the reaction like there in the United States?
Well, as you can imagine, it would be mixed. You have those on one side who are saying that this is an injustice. You had someone who took a gun and killed two people and injured a third person, a person who won't be able to use that arm probably for the rest of his life. And then you have those who say that a justice was done, that Kyle Rittenhouse was allowed to defend himself, and therefore the jury ruled, or the jury decided in the right manner. Well, both can be right, and here's why I think that there is a little bit of a dichotomy when it comes down to understanding this case. It is possible that the way that the law is written in the state of Wisconsin, that Rittenhouse was in the clear legally doing what he did, but at the same time, he could have done something that was immoral, and that is taking out a gun and bringing it to a protest for the potentiality that he would have to use it and kill someone. The thing here is that the defense really framed their case in the proper way, that it really came down to self-defense. The way that the jury was picked was also very strategic. And you had, you had a set of 11 people. Only all of them were white, except for one person. And so you have that sympathy card possibly here as well, especially when you had an 18-year-old crying on the stand as he was giving his testimony as well. Usually, when you have a defendant, from a legal standpoint, you don't usually want them to take the stand. But here, the defense thought that it was very strategic to have an 18-year-old on the stand, somebody with very boyish, youngish looks, and who also cried on the stand. So it kind of elicited maybe a sympathy type of mentality coming from the jury. So when you break down the way that this case played out legally, the way the defense tried to, or the way that the defense framed the case in a matter of self-defense, and the way that they put Rittenhouse on the stand, the prosecutors really had an uphill battle trying to prosecute this case. And as we saw, the judge in this case seemed to be a little bit friendlier to the defense, allowing Kyle Rittenhouse to hand select anonymous jurors for his case, playing music for him, and then at times chiding the prosecution for their strategy in trying to prosecute the case. So there are a lot of people who are not really surprised by the outcome of this case. A lot of people allude to white hegemony as being the underlying reason where a white kid can go out into a crowd with a loaded gun and kill two people and now can live the rest of his life without really any reprisal except for this trial, right? And so a lot of people point to just the hypocrisy where you won't see that coming from a non-white person where they kill two people and really are held to no account for their actions.
Yeah, Colin, you would imagine if it was the other way around how the trial would have unfolded then. But just very quickly, Colin, just we've got a minute left. Just something just doesn't sound right here, because you've got, I mean, that you say you've already noted the question marks over the trial, but then two people have been killed, a third injured, two people have lost their lives. Not even a manslaughter charge. I would imagine the anti-racism movement will not be very happy about that.
No, but it also raises concerns in the future. If there are further protests, we're not going to see the end of violence coming from either white vigilantism or from the police. And therefore, are protesters going to have the courage or the wherewithal or just the determination to still show up in large numbers, knowing that there could be someone out there, another vigilante, who might be out there to take their lives in a show of protest? So that's also very dangerous. Some other people have talked about a possible civil suit coming from the families and from the victims, so that we could see that in the future, but that remains unsure for now. We do know that the statements coming from at least one of the families said that a grave injustice had been done after the verdict was read.
Colin, thank you very much indeed. Colin Campbell there, our correspondent, joining us live from Washington, D.C. Now, a new move in the U.S. risks fueling its already simmering tensions with Russia. The U.S. Congress is considering whether to recognize the presidency of Vladimir Putin if he wins another term in office. Moscow says the U.S. is interfering in its internal affairs.
The long-standing rivalry between Russia and the United States has taken a new turn. This time, Washington is mulling whether or not to recognize the presidency of Vladimir Putin if he is re-elected. This is proposed in a cross-party resolution introduced by two U.S. congressmen. It calls for the U.S. to end its recognition of Vladimir Putin's presidency beyond his current term, which expires in May 2024. The bill claims that the recent amendments to the Russian Constitution, which enabled the Russian president to run for another term, are legally void. The motion has drawn fierce condemnation from the Kremlin.
Every time we think there is nothing more absurd, aggressive, unfriendly, and unconstructive that can come from that side of the ocean, and every time we are wrong, unfortunately, this is a perfect demonstration not only to Russia, but to all countries of the world that the United States officially interferes in the internal affairs of other countries.
But the U.S. is no stranger to getting involved in other nations' internal affairs. Just this Tuesday, President Joe Biden banned members of the Nicaraguan government from entering the United States. He alleged that Nicaragua's November 7 vote was rigged in favor of President Daniel Ortega. In response, the Nicaraguan Congress denounced Washington for violating the principle of non-intervention in its foreign policy. Washington's failure to recognize the elected leaders of such nations as Syria and Venezuela has also drawn strongly worded condemnations for years. The U.S., however, presses on with the interference, which runs contrary to the Charter of the United Nations.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned. This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In a New York City borough where residents have long struggled to afford their homes, thousands of people are now threatened with eviction as state pandemic aid dwindles. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Mir Zaveri, Matthew Haag, and Sophia Cerda Campero. The piece is titled How the Pandemic Worsened the Housing Crisis in the Bronx. Stay with us for more of the New York Times article. Olivia Fernandez used to commute every day from her one-bedroom apartment in the Bronx in New York City to an Ecuadorian restaurant in Queens, where she worked as a cook and earned $700 a week. But when the pandemic hit New York City last year, the restaurant shut down and she lost her job. Ms. Fernandez got COVID-19 in March of 2020, and ever since, she has felt weak and unable to work. Her two young daughters were also infected. For 20 months, Olivia Fernandez has not paid her $1,400 rent. She owes more than $28,000. Her landlord has yet to demand payment, instead hoping that Ms. Fernandez would qualify for a state pandemic relief program. But with the rent relief program now nearly out of money, Ms. Fernandez knows her housing situation is precarious. Where will I go with two daughters? Miss Fernandez says. I can't live in the streets. The pandemic has left millions of people across the country jobless and on the brink of losing their homes. But few places better illustrate the escalating housing crisis than the Bronx neighborhood of New York City, where working-class residents have long struggled to afford the city's rising cost of living. Before the pandemic, more than one-third of households in the Bronx spent at least half of their income on rent. More than 26,000 renters in the borough have been sued by their landlord since the pandemic began, the highest concentration of eviction cases in New York State, and more than in many large American cities, including Philadelphia, St. Louis, Cincinnati, according to the Eviction Laboratory at Princeton University. A state moratorium on evictions, one of the strongest in the nation, has helped keep the number of cases from being even higher. They are far below pre-pandemic levels. While many lawsuits do not lead to actual evictions, the mere filing of a case can land a renter on a so-called tenant blacklist, making it much more difficult to find and qualify for another apartment. Still, many residents, like Livia Fernandez, remain out of work and unable to pay their rent. The 12.4% unemployment rate in the Bronx neighborhood in September was almost triple the national figure. More than $248 million in pandemic rent relief has been distributed in the borough of Bronx, according to the most recent data, more than in the entire states of Indiana, Arizona, and Connecticut combined. The state has been so overwhelmed with requests for aid that it has stopped accepting new applications and says that more than 70,000 pending applications could be left in limbo without more federal funds. Interviews with landlords and tenants paint a very grim portrait of a borough in distress, where the housing crisis is straining economic recovery. Some of those who did not receive or qualify for rent relief because they did not submit an application or did not meet the criteria may face eviction once the moratorium expires this January. Others will struggle for years to climb out of debt. Without rental income, property owners could let buildings slip into disrepair. I'm very concerned about the long-term impact of such a momentous event, said Matthew Murphy, the executive director of the New York University Furman Center. Ever since she moved to New York City from Guayaquil in Ecuador 3 years ago, Livia Fernandez has worked as a cook. Since she lost her job, she has struggled to find work. She got COVID-19 again this March and has been unable to stand for long periods of time. I can't find a full-time job because I feel physically weak, she says. She cannot afford food and sometimes gets help from a nearby church pantry. She's especially concerned for her daughters, Clara and Marta. I can go hungry, she says, but they can't. I do nails, I clean apartments, I do anything. She applied for the rent relief program when the landlord of her Mott Haven building pushed her, but she said she had not received any notice that her application was being considered. I break down and start crying, she says, but then I control myself because who will take care of my daughters if I'm not around? Her landlord, Inocencio Gonzalez, could not be reached for comment. Without a job, Livia Fernandez is anxious about the future. Thank God my landlord hasn't been pushing or bothering with the rent money, but months keep passing by and my pressure has gone up a lot, she says. Mercedes Escoto, a 63-year-old, has not paid rent on her two-bedroom apartment in the High Bridge neighborhood of New York City since April of 2020. As of October, the sum of her unpaid bills, according to a letter she got from her landlord, was more than $43,000. In May of this year, the landlord filed court papers seeking her eviction. But like many renters facing eviction during the pandemic, her troubles had begun long before. 5 years ago, her landlord abruptly raised the monthly rent from around $1,400 to $2,000, she said. The rent would have claimed almost half of her income. Ms. Scotto earns around $59,000 a year as a social worker and also takes care of her mother, who lives with her. I told them from the get-go I could not pay all of that, she says. Unable to afford the increase, she fell behind on rent. She borrowed money from a city emergency assistance program and took roughly $11,000 out of her retirement account for back rent, money she is still paying back. The pandemic worsened Ms. Scotto's financial woes. Her mother got COVID-19 in March of 2020 and needs a walker, oxygen, and pain pills. Ms. Scotto had to take weeks off work without pay. She struggled with anxiety and depression. I used to cry every day, she says. It was all too much for me. She also said she had a leaky bathroom ceiling and non-functional oven, emblematic of issues that are particularly prevalent in rent-stabilized buildings like hers. Unlike the city's other four boroughs, the Bronx has many more rent-stabilized units than unregulated apartments. She says that even if she could afford to pay back the rent, she is reluctant to do so until the repairs are made, especially as the moratorium on evictions has kept her case from moving forward. Mercedes Scotto has also applied for rent relief from the state. The landlord, a limited liability company associated with Isaac Casira, who has received national attention for pushing to gentrify affordable housing, filed papers last year seeking to deregulate the building so it can charge higher rents. In an email statement, Todd Rothenberg, a lawyer representing the landlord, said Ms. Scotto has not paid a single penny in 21 months. While the landlord has to pay me his property taxes, his mortgage, the heating, the hot water bill, etc., without any income whatsoever from Ms. Scotto. He noted that the landlord had agreed to charge Ms. Scotto a lower rent, around $1,500 a month, in October of 2020. It was not clear why she was still receiving bills reflecting a higher amount.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and how about pondering on a wonderful maxim from the Holy Prophet's 11th infallible heir, Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him. The worst of people is he who has two faces and two tongues, praises his brother in front of him, and eats his flesh in his absence.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, being religious. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of being religious. What does it mean and what effects does it have in our lifestyle when we talk about the Islamic lifestyle? Does being religious an important thing or not? Or can someone who's not religious have or adopt the Islamic lifestyle and reach to perfection? Now, one thing which we need to bear in our minds that when we are talking about the lifestyle and especially Islamic lifestyle, it is to take us, this lifestyle will take us towards the perfection, which is known as sa'adat in Arabic. So the word sa'adat in Arabic means that you reach to perfection, you have a good life in this world and a good ending in hereafter. This does not mean that you are suffering in this life, in this world, in order to get a better life in hereafter. No. Sa'adat or success or perfection means that you had a good life, a successful life in this world, and you have a good and successful life in hereafter. So when we talk about the lifestyle and we talk about being religious, it does not mean that a person who does not follow religion, who is not religious, can reach to perfection. Now, why do we say so? It is because that being religious is being negatively translated or defined in the general life, in the West especially. You know, in the West they say like the being religious means you're so much conservative and you just do what you think and what religion says. You do not enjoy your life. You do not communicate with people so much because you're religious. And religious, being religious means that you live alone and you do not socialize.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of being religious, and we said generally in the West, or generally people, they think like being religious means that you live alone, you do not socialize in people, you're very conservative, and you do not socialize in a way that the others do, and you do not even enjoy your life. You do not have any entertainment or enjoyment in your life. This is a concept that is generally given for a person who is being religious. Now, let's look at the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about the Islamic lifestyle and the being religious in Islam, what does it mean? It means that you do not disobey Allah Almighty. And that's it. This is the simplest definition of being religious. Being religious means that you do not disobey Allah Almighty. For example, if Allah has forbidden the alcohol, then you do not go go towards alcohol. If Allah has forbidden the, mixed gathering marriages or the places where there's a mixed gathering, the mixed gathering itself is not a bad thing. But the problem is if you see people are dressed in a way which is forbidden, or if they are not basically having the veils and the place where you're going, it's not suitable for you, then obviously you avoid such things. So this is what it means, actually, being religious, that you do not disobey Allah. If Allah has said to eat halal, you go for halal foods only. You do not go for haram. But it does not mean that you do not enjoy your life. You enjoy through the halal means. That's what it means, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Paleontologists in Brazil have discovered remains that could belong to a species of dinosaur as yet unknown. The fossils were found at a site in northeastern Brazil. A team of scientists is trying to put together the bones and complete the huge dinosaur's skeleton. They think it lived during the Cretaceous period, which began around 145 million years ago and ended with extinction of all dinosaurs roughly 66 million years ago.
Study shows that moderate consumption of tea and coffee may be better for your health than previously thought. The study conducted by a Chinese medical university says tea and coffee can help keep stroke and dementia at bay. And if you're wondering what is meant by moderate consumption, it's defined as something between 2 and 5 cups of tea and coffee, either alone or combined in one day. The study followed more than 360,000 people aged 50 to 74 for over a decade. Some scientists have praised the study as robust. Others, however, say the participants were all selected from the UK Biobank, which means they're healthier than the general population. Pomegranate has a special place in Iranian culture. There is a trace of the fruit everywhere from poetry to cooking. Iranians even hold a pomegranate festival in the fall. This year, the event is held in one of the main parks in the capital, Tehran. The festival features different varieties of pomegranates that are grown across Iran. The visitors can also find pomegranate products, including juices, concentrates, and dressings. The event includes cultural parades, music concerts, and traditional live performances. Iranians say they always welcome the pomegranate season, as it's one of the old symbols in the country's literature and art. Christmas season always brings happiness and joy to people around the world. Many Parisians these days are taking a respite from their daily routines and hitting famous departmental stores now light up with present boxes. Cheerful families could be spotted at Christmas-decorated galleries, Lafayette and Printemps department stores. Automated figures and colorful window displays are the center of attractions for them and their children. It's a season when people buy Christmas. Christmas gifts for their loved ones, and stores make big profits this time around. Many Parisians say they want to take advantage of this period as the government is debating whether or not to impose a COVID-related lockdown. In Venezuela, a large number of musicians are striving for one common goal, and that's setting the Guinness record as the world's largest orchestra. Over 12,000 musicians, mostly children and adolescents, have played together to make that happen. Hundreds of violins, violas, and double basses playing in unison at this setting in Caracas. The musicians are all connected to the country's network of youth orchestras. For them to set a record, over 8,000 instruments had to play at the same time during a 5-minute period of a classical piece. Right now, a Russian orchestra that played the country's national anthem is holding the record. Once done, the crowd of musicians erupted in cheers, lifting their instruments and waving Venezuelan flags. Guinness will announce its decision in the next 10 days. Tourists and residents in Los Angeles have been mesmerized by a dazzling new event the U.S. city is hosting, with holiday-themed and a full of colorful lights. Visitors can enjoy a mile-long walkway covered on all sides with brightly lit installations. Artists from around the world have taken part in the exhibition. The centerpiece display is a cathedral tunnel lit with thousands of bulbs. Another amazing attraction is the orbs, lit up with thousands of torches. The event has been a huge hit with the LA public.
Oh my gosh, it's so nice.
And it gets to be out in the open, and it's like a perfect night to do it, so it's great.
It's definitely the best. Like, we had to do, like, in a car to go see lights, and then we got to, like, now, like, go around and actually walk and get to see everything up close, which is super nice.
Yeah.
Definitely after the, what, year and a half that we've had.
Yeah.
So.
And it's really nice to see everything up close, because it's like, you see in a photo, but then it's more real.
The event opened to the public on the 12th of November and will run for 5 nights. Preparations for the event, however, started a month ago. The organizers say millions of bulbs and 17 miles of cables are used for the 18 art installations.
From a gray and gloomy look to a cheery and colorful appearance. That's the story of how a neighborhood in Peru's capital, Lima, is being transformed to become a tourist attraction. A group of artists in Lima are bringing color and joy to this hilly neighborhood by painting the walls of houses. Creating an optical illusion of a giant mural, the project is visible from different spots across the city. The designers are hoping what they did can improve the lives of residents in a neighborhood that was considered to be unsafe before.
What we are doing here is communal work with all the neighbors, and we are doing it because it's important to change the environment through the use of colors. This hill was considered an unsafe and dangerous area of the city, so we decided to change that social stigma through art, which for me as a muralist is the best tool to achieve it.
The project was started 5 months ago, and workers are now putting the final touches to their work of art. The mural covers over 300,000 square meters. It's the largest in South America.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
life of a baby sloth at an uncharacteristically hasty speed has surprised London zookeepers. A tiny two-toed sloth named Terry was born to a mother, Marilyn, at the weekend. The zookeepers say there was no sign at all that Marilyn was going into labor when they checked her in the morning. However, less than an hour, they spotted something like a tiny arm tucked into her tummy. Marilyn had quietly delivered the baby with no fuss at all while her keepers were chopping up sweet potatoes for her breakfast. The mother and baby are said to be doing well, but the zookeepers still don't know the sex of the baby.
Modern technology has changed our lives in countless ways, with robots now preparing to lend a hand in operation rooms. Surgical robots are on display at the 4th China International Import Expo. One of the machines, dubbed Mazer X, gives assistance in spinal surgery. Employing the robot can lessen bleeding by 50% compared to open surgeries. Another one assists doctors to perform interventional surgeries.
Guide valves in the vessels can be controlled even less than 1 millimeter. This is not cannot be achieved by the human hands. With the great, I think, market impact from this showcase, we successfully performed a first case PCI in Hainan Boao on March 13th.
The producers say surgical robots will soon operate in more hospitals around China. Therefore, training centers have been established to help surgeons learn how to operate the new generation of surgical robots.
Tigress belonging to the endangered Bengal species has given birth to four cubs at the Mexican Zoo, bringing joy and hope to wildlife enthusiasts. The four were born in the San Jorge Park in the city of Ciudad Juarez on October 10th. Nearly a month on, they are in good health. And that is good news, because usually when multiple cubs are born, not all of them survive. Zoo officials have not yet determined the sex of the newborn cubs. That is because their mother lets out a roar when the vets are nearby. Bengal tigers are endangered for two reasons: poaching and the destruction of their natural habitat. Here's what you can call killing two birds with one stone. Classic car lovers have gone on an exciting rally to see an erupting volcano. The event, organized by Beshbuk Rallies, happened on a Saturday. Motorists taking part in the vintage rally had the unique opportunity to witness a volcano erupting ash and smoke. Most of the participants tried to get as close as they could to the volcano, but there were also those who chose to take other vehicles because they were afraid that their precious antique cars would be damaged.
Often, it does not take much to bring about positive social change. In Johannesburg, a group of painters are creating artworks on the trolleys of street recyclers. Reason? To encourage bystanders to look up and notice the work recyclers, locally known as reclaimers, do in the community.
I like my work to have meaning, so when I get to paint and become a part of a project like this, it's great for me, you know, because it's not every day we get to like do stuff like this, so yeah.
Up until now, they were just filthy looking jumbo bags with recyclable waste reeling along the streets. But thanks to graffiti artists who are giving them a makeover with bold and bright designs to help identify and protect the recyclers, artists say their goal is to build a relationship between neighborhood residents and waste pickers. The reclaimers roam around the city day and night, with some motorists even considering them a risk, as the trolleys are not always visible. There are some 6,000 reclaimers in Johannesburg who
sorting, recycling garbage. It's a messy job, but they do it anyway. A group of women are joining hands to protect one of India's key natural sites that is also on UNESCO's heritage list, the Western Ghats, a mountain chain that's facing severe deforestation. The 27 members of this all-female task force are doing all they can to protect the area's rare ferns, mosses, and thousands of other plants. They're using a variety of gardening tools and techniques to preserve species from all over the mountains. Not only that, but they also make artificial conditions and habitats for endangered species from other parts of the world, mainly those affected by climate change. One of the conservationists explained that what they are doing is actually helping the forest regenerate.
We have witnessed the birth of a forest, and that's a very powerful thing. You know, the mind is filled with the ghastly stories of forests being cut, like the Amazon or like the Western Ghats, but here we're witness to the birth of forests as well, and that is the forest itself birthing itself, you see.
The Western Ghats Mountains are home to nearly 5,000 species of flowering plants, but many of them are globally threatened. Only less than half of the area's flora is currently under conservation. Scientists say the outlook for the mountain is very concerning. Carbon dioxide is one of the causes of global warming, but can we get rid of it to save our planet? A Swiss firm has come up with a novel idea to store CO2 underground and turn it into rocks. Company Climeworks has started operating the world's largest direct air carbon capture and storage plant called Okra in Iceland. Located in Hershey, Okra is entirely run on renewable energy. It soaks carbon dioxide directly from the air and buries it as rocks deep underground to be mineralized. Usually, a natural process takes hundreds of thousands of years to turn the gas into basaltic rocks, but here it takes up to 2 years for the CO2 to turn into white crystals.
Once the carbon dioxide is captured, it will be dissolved in water, and here we are at the injection site. The carbon dioxide dissolved in water will come through this pipe into the well, where it will be injected into the volcanic rock at a depth of between 800 meters and 2 kilometers.
The plant is said to be removing 4,000 tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere each year. The amount is too little to save the planet from carbon emissions, as climate modeling suggests the world needs to eliminate several billion tons per year by 2050. Here we have to take into account the saying of the head of Orca that we have to learn to walk before we can run.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
We cannot rely on the US or its allies to champion democracy around the world. projects at Global Grassroots Movement Progressive International. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. and its allies are fueling worldwide erosion of democracy, analysis shows. Stay tuned for more. Recent internal attacks on democracy and human rights by the United States and many of its allies, which often portray themselves as exporters of such ideals, are driving an overall erosion of democracy worldwide, according to a new analysis. The New York Times analyzed an annual report released earlier this year by VDEM, a Swedish research institute that collects data on democracy and autocratic governments around the world, finding that the United States and several of the countries it's considered allies in recent decades have shifted substantially away from operating as democracies, with attacks on voting rights, judicial independence, and the rights of the media among the factors driving the erosion. Much of the world's backsliding is not imposed on democracies by foreign powers, but rather is a rot rising within the world's most powerful network of mostly democratic alliances. The U.S. and its allies drove increases in democracy scores, according to VDEM's reporting, throughout the 1990s, accounting for 9% of democratic growth around the world. But in the past decade, the Times analysis showed 36% of all democratic backsliding has happened in the U.S. and U.S.-aligned countries and regimes. Max Fisher at the Times wrote, "Much of the world's backsliding is not imposed on democracies by foreign powers, but rather is a rot rising within the world's most powerful network of mostly democratic alliances." VDM's report titled "Autocratization Turns Viral" pointed to the arrest of journalists for their reporting on the coronavirus pandemic and the detention of hundreds of citizens for discussing the issue on social media as examples of democratic erosion that has intensified in the last year. The group pointed to an assault on the judiciary and the press in Hungary as evidence of the deterioration of democracy dating back to as early as 2010, when the right-wing government led by Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party enacted several media laws that curtailed media freedom substantially. The Times analysis comes amid an intensifying assault on voting rights and elections by the Republican Party in the U.S., and the failure of the Democratic Party, which controls the White House and both chambers of Congress, to eliminate the legislative filibuster to allow the passage of far-reaching voting rights legislation. As Common Dreams reported earlier this month, the state-level congressional maps drawn by Republican legislatures could give the party a 13-2 advantage among representatives to the U.S. House, while the conservative takeover of the federal courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, has put reproductive rights in peril. VDEM's report also pointed to the spread of disinformation that the U.S. government has frequently engaged in regarding the U.S. COVID-19 pandemic, with anti-science claims from the right, including former President Donald Trump,